To hear the closed captioning, to hear closed captioning or view closed captioning, please click on the CC icon on the top of the screen, or you can click on Control F8 and adjust your screen. If you have questions, please type and submit your questions into the chat area text box, which is located to the left side of your monitor, or press Control M and enter your text in the chat area. We do ask that you please don't use emoticons or hand-raising features during the session because it may be confusing or distracting to the other participants. I would like now to take this opportunity to introduce our speakers for confidentiality under the ADA and other laws. Barry Taylor is the Legal Advocacy Director at Equip for Equality. Alan Goldstein is the Senior Attorney at Equip for Equality. And we'd also like to recognize at this time the valuable assistance provided by Joseph Schwartz. May I ask Barry for you to go ahead and begin our session for us at this time?
Great, thanks. Hello everybody, it's Barry Taylor from Equip for Equality and I'm going to be the first speaker, so I'll get us started. I wanted to let people know that if you are an attorney in Illinois, licensed in Illinois, because Equip for Equality is a licensed continuing legal education provider, you are entitled to 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit. All you need to do is send me an email after this session indicating that you listened to the whole session, and my email address is barryt@equipforequality.org, and then I will in turn have a certificate sent to you. And we're going to have this slide at the end of the session as well in case you need that. So it's always good when we do these sessions to see who's on the line, and so we're going to do a quick poll, and we'd like you to let us know who's listening today. So if you look in the participant box, you'll see an A, a B, or a C. So if you are an advocate for a person with disability or a person with a disability yourself that's interested in these issues, click on A. If you represent employers or other covered entities, you can click on B. And if you're neither, which we call innocent, unbiased bystanders, you can just click on C. If you're using your keypad, you can also do Control 1 for A as an advocate for people with disabilities, Control 2 for B as representative employers or other covered entities, and C for if you don't fall under either of those categories. So please vote now, and we'll see who's on the line today. So it looks like we have a nice distribution. We've got about 32% are advocates for people with disabilities, 24 are covered entities, and then we've got 3% who don't fall under any of those categories, and then some of you who haven't voted yet. So thanks for giving us that information. And there we go. So let's move on to what we're talking about today. What we're going to divide the session up is into two parts. I'm going to start with the first part and really focus on where a lot of the case law is, which is the confidentiality under the employment provisions of the Americans with Disabilities Act, Title I, and talk about how confidentiality arises in that context. Then we'll stop to see if anybody has any questions. And then Alan will continue the presentation, and he's going to talk about a variety of things. He's going to talk about confidentiality under the ADA that does not involve employment, Titles 2 and 3. He'll also talk about cases that raise the Rehabilitation Act, Civil Rights Act, and 14th Amendment. And then he's also going to discuss some other laws outside of the traditional discrimination laws that you may not be aware of. One is a newly passed law called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, or GINA, which was passed a few years ago. And then he's also going to talk about HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. And he's also going to just give a quick reference that about state laws as well. One thing we wanted to make sure you do if you want background information on some of these issues is we have a brief that we prepared for the Great Lakes ADA Center that there's a link on this slide where you can get that publication. That brief goes into a lot of the sort of what's permitted to ask, so the sort of the privacy issues, what can employers ask and when can they ask it. So you're probably all aware that before a conditional offer of employment, employers aren't allowed to ask disability-related questions or have people undergo any kind of medical examination. But after a conditional offer of employment, they can make those inquiries and examinations But if they take an adverse action as a result of the information from those inquiries and examinations, then they have to show that that decision was job-related and consistent with business necessity. And then there also are things in the brief that talk about that once a person is an employee, that employers also can only get disability-related information if it's job-related or consistent with business necessity. We'll reference those issues a little bit, but really what we're going to be focusing on is more the traditional confidentiality issues. What happens once the employer has the information or the other entity has the information, and what are the restrictions and responsibilities involved in that? So we have on this slide information from the statute itself that indicates that if the employer does obtain information about a person's medical condition or history, that it is important that it and is required that employers keep that information on a separate form in a separate medical file and treat it as a confidential medical record. So that means it has to be kept separate from a personnel file. If you are a covered entity right now and you are putting medical information with the employee's personnel file, that is a violation of the ADA. So you need to make sure that those medical information is kept separate in a confidential medical file. And the reason being is that a lot of people have access to personnel files that should not have access to confidential medical information. So that separate file is very important. The ADA does indicate some exceptions to this rule. Basically, the first one is the one we see most often, that supervisors and managers may be informed regarding necessary restrictions of work or duties and necessary accommodations, sort of a need-to-know kind of thing, but it's not a blanket opening for supervisors and managers to have access to the information. It has to be because something's happened that gives them the need to know that information. Also, there's an exception for first aid and safety personnel when appropriate, as well as government officials that are investigating compliance. But really that first subsection, supervisors and managers on need to know, is where it really comes up mostly. And then the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has issued regulations giving us a little bit more information, and their regulations indicate that confidentiality applies really in three major contexts that they indicate. One is when people are undergoing entrance examinations and inquiries. Others, when there are medical examinations, once the person is employed. And then also any kind of voluntary health programs that employees participate once they're hired. The EEOC goes on to provide a lot of guidance beyond the regulations, which I think will be helpful. And if you look at the bottom of this slide, you'll see links to two different documents. One is specifically on pre-employment related questions and medical exams. And there's also a link to the EEOC's guidance on reasonable accommodation. And that's a more general document. But within that general document, there are a lot of there is a lot of guidance from the EEOC with respect to confidentiality in the context of reasonable accommodation. So I would, if you haven't read those before, I would urge you to take a look at those because they are useful in giving you the EEOC's perspective. The EEOC indicates that their view is that any information, all medical information, including information related to reasonable accommodation requests, are to be kept confidential, and that employers have to obtain a release when they want to speak to an employee's doctor. They also talk about, sort of building on what we talked about before, that medical information can be given to appropriate decision makers involved in the hiring process on a need-to-know basis. And does indicate that medical information can be shared to third parties as part of the reasonable accommodation process. But again, even though you're sharing it with a third party, that third party then has an obligation to keep that information confidential. Also, as we'll see in one of the cases we're going to talk about, the confidentiality about a person's disability has to be maintained even after the employment or the application process ends. So just because an employee leaves your employment doesn't mean that you can disclose that information, such as in a job reference check or something like that. You still have that obligation to keep it confidential. So who is protected under the confidentiality provisions? Well, your gut response would be, well, if you're a person with a disability under the ADA, you're protected. Well, actually, the ADA has been interpreted to be a little broader than that, because if you look at the provisions, these provisions under the ADA, most of the provisions of the ADA talk about qualified individuals with disabilities being protected, or people who meet the definition of disability. But this provision talks about not people with disabilities, but they talk about applicants and employees. And so most courts, when interpreting this, have said, We believe that this provision can be enforced not only by people who can show an ADA disability, but any employee or applicant who is asked improper questions or asked to undergo improper examinations. And the Roe case from the 10th Circuit, I think, explains sort of the reasoning behind this. It says it makes little sense to require an employee to demonstrate that he has a disability to prevent his employer from inquiring as to whether or not he has a disability. So sort of a vicious circle there. And so that's why you don't have to necessarily prove that you have a disability in order to enforce the confidentiality provisions under the ADA. Even though you don't have to show you have a disability, you do have to show that you have some sort of tangible injury. Now, courts have interpreted injury generally pretty broad. They say it doesn't have to be an economic injury, like that you've suffered some sort of loss in wages or things like that. It can be emotional injury, like harassment or emotional distress. And the EEOC versus Ford Motor Company case is a good example of that. That person could not show a financial loss or damages, but they could show that he had suffered shame, embarrassment, and depressions, and that was a tangible enough injury. This was a case involving an employee with HIV whose disability had been disclosed. What had happened there was the employee had sought a scheduling change so he could participate in a clinical study, and the employer had disclosed that to others, his HIV to others in the workplace. And the court said that his shame, embarrassment, and depression by that disclosure was sufficient to show that he had a tangible injury. I think important in that case was that the employee actually took a medical leave as a result of this disclosure, and I think that actual tangible medical leave might have helped the plaintiff in that case. As you'll see in the cases we talked about, one of the pivotal issues in these cases is whether or not the information was mandated to be provided by the employer, and therefore one that employers definitely have to keep confidential, or whether it was a voluntary disclosure by the employee. And as you'll see, here we have some examples of what are considered employer-mandated inquiries, like requirements for leave under the FMLA or the ADA. So if they're requiring you to fill out a form for FMLA leave and you're disclosing a disability, that would be employer-mandated, so you could obtain that benefit. Medical examination and inquiries of applicants or employees, fitness for duty examinations, other types of mandatory requests for information, medical support for a reasonable accommodation request. We have in parentheticals there usually, because there are some courts that have said that that's not necessarily employer mandated information that is protected. Usually it is, but not always, as we'll see in some of the cases, or some sort of redisclosure that was permitted on a need-to-know basis. And then voluntary disclosures really include almost any other thing that would come up in the workplace, like casual discussions and disclosures that weren't in response to some sort of formalized mandatory request for information. So general questions like, how you feeling, what's up, what's wrong, those kinds of things, courts have viewed to be those to be voluntary. Now, why is it important if it's voluntary or not? Well, the EEOC has said that they believe that voluntary disclosures are still required to be protected. However, most courts have said that if it's voluntary, it's not protected. And so what we see in a lot of these cases is a lot of battling back and forth as to whether something was voluntarily disclosed or not, and therefore protected, whether or not it's protected. So we're going to give you some examples of what's protected. And well, first, the Scherer case, I think, is kind of summarizes what I just said, and that is that courts have generally allowed claims of illegal disclosure of confidential medical information when a supervisor is probing for medical information for accommodation purposes or trying to get medical information. But when the employee has volunteered the information to a supervisor, when the supervisor hasn't really requested medical information, courts have generally found that there's no requirement to keep that confidential and found in favor of employers in that case. So we'll talk about a few cases, and I've already referenced this EEOC versus Ford Motor Company case. That's the case involving the gentleman who had HIV and disclosed it to the supervisor when he needed FMLA leave. And then the supervisor redisclosed his HIV conditions, which caused him such distress. And the court found this was clearly not voluntary. It was a prerequisite for him to receive the family medical leave, and therefore it was a breach of confidentiality that would be actionable under the ADA. The Doe case, also on this slide, had a similar finding. Again, somebody with HIV who disclosed in their request for FMLA leave, and the court found that that was confidential, and therefore the coworker should not have learned of his condition. One thing I wanted to point out in the Doe case is that in addition to the ADA, the plaintiff also raised a law called the Federal Privacy Act of 1974, which prohibits federal agencies from disclosing any record to another person or agency without consent of the person. So it's not specifically a disability-related case or a statute. It's more of a privacy statute, one that I actually wasn't familiar with. So if you are involved in these kinds of cases, you want to look not only at the ADA and some of the other laws that Alan will talk about, but also this Federal Privacy Act of 1974. It may be a basis for relief as well. And then the Fisher case also found in favor of the employee. This was an employee who had hepatitis C, and it was a violation there when the supervisor required a doctor's note and then left the information that the employee provided in the break room. This was sort of a bizarre factual pattern in that the employer, the HR person, instead of keeping the information confidential, would just put things in a break room and leave them for days on end, and did it more than once, and it was just a strange type of thing. The thing I also wanted to point out in this case is this was brought under the Rehabilitation Act. It was an entity receiving federal funds, and the court said it's clear that the Rehabilitation Act incorporates the ADA's medical confidentiality provisions, and the court again said that the medical document request was treated as job-related inquiry as to whether the employee was able to perform the essential functions and therefore had to be kept confidential. We're going to talk about a few more cases as far as what's protected in the context of reasonable accommodation. The Blanco case is the first one, and this was a plaintiff who had ADHD and had disclosed it when he needed a reasonable accommodation. He did not disclose this when he had a post-offer medical questionnaire. He didn't think it was applicable. He thought they were looking for more physical medical conditions and not his ADHD wouldn't necessarily apply. So he didn't disclose that. And then after he was employed, he sought the reasonable accommodation and disclosed his ADHD. And frankly, it looked like the employer just got really ticked off that he hadn't disclosed this at the initial examination. And so they terminated him, they said, because he had lied on the medical questionnaire and failed to provide accurate information. And they didn't even discuss whether he was entitled to an accommodation or not. So he sued under the ADA, claiming that they violated his confidentiality by disclosing this ADHD. And the court said that, and in response, the employer said, well, the confidentiality provisions are really only about disclosing it to outsiders. And the court said, no, the ADA confidentiality provisions not only apply to disclosure to outsiders, but also within the company, which makes sense because that's where a lot of the disclosures happen to coworkers. So that was just reconfirming, I think, which was something that was fairly obvious before. The court said it was a possible violation by the physician to disclose the ADHD to the company managers as part of the accommodation request, and so they let the case proceed. And the employer had tried to say, well, he had provided false information, and they said even if he's providing false information, inaccurate information, if it later comes to light that he needs an accommodation, the ADA confidentiality provisions still apply. Then the other case on this slide is the Medlin case, which actually also found in favor of the plaintiff. This was an employee who had been required to undergo a functional capacity evaluation after he had a back injury. And he actually found out the results of the functional capacity evaluation from coworkers because the person who performed the evaluation had disclosed it to coworkers before they even disclosed it to him. And the court said that the functional capacity evaluation is a medical examination and inquiry for ADA purposes and therefore is required to be kept confidential. Another case involving reasonable accommodation information is the Cripe case out of the District of Columbia. And this was an individual who had HIV, and his attorney had sent the employer a letter requesting different work accommodations. He was seeking to telecommute. He had been given an accommodation to telecommute, and he wanted to continue that after it had been revoked for other employees. And the employer had demanded, you know, a basis why he needed this continued telecommuting accommodation. So the attorney sent a letter documenting that the person did have HIV. Unfortunately, the employer failed to keep the letter confidential. The particular supervisor left the letter sitting right on his desk, and a nosy coworker was in the supervisor's office and read it on the desk and then disclosed it to other coworkers. And so he ended up suing under the ADA for breach of confidentiality. And the court said, yes, this is a violation of the ADA. The employer had tried to say that it wasn't really confidential because they hadn't marked the letter specifically confidential. And the court said, you know, we're not going to buy that argument. You don't have to mark a document confidential in order for it to be confidential. And therefore, that's not a requirement under the ADA. They also, court said here that it was also not just a voluntary disclosure, because it was at the request of the employer as part of the accommodation request review. So here the court found that when you're asking for information according for an accommodation, when you get information back from that, that has to be kept confidential. We're looking at some other cases involving voluntary disclosure. The Shearer case, which we had cited earlier, was a case involving an employee who had disclosed that she was undergoing a breast biopsy when she was filling out an unrelated medical form. And the supervisor just casually said, is everything okay? And she said, yeah, or she said, no, not really. I'm having to go undergo a breast biopsy. And then that information was subsequently disclosed to other coworkers. And the court said, you know, that was really a voluntary disclosure, and therefore was not something that had to be kept confidential. Another case involving similar situation is the EEOC versus Thrivent Financial case. And in that case, you had an employee who had migraines, and when he missed work, he disclosed that to his supervisor. After his supervisor left a message, you know, give us a call, we need to know what's going on, because it was unusual for this particular coworker not to call in when he wasn't going to be in, and they were very worried, so they called, left a message, and he responded and said, yeah, I've got really bad migraines. He subsequently quit, and when he applied for a new job, he found out his former supervisor was revealing his migraine information. And so he sued under the ADA saying they breached his confidentiality after he left his employment and his former employer was disclosing his migraines. And the court disagreed with him and said, no, this is not confidential information. You voluntarily disclosed this information. It's not protected under the ADA, because the information was not in response to a request by the employer for medical information. It was in response to a general question about, you know, we need to know what's going on. Sometimes it feels like courts are splitting hairs on this, but courts are pretty consistent here. And even though the EEOC says that questions that are likely to lead to disability information should be kept confidential, most courts, including this court, disagree. They think the EEOC is taking too broad an approach here, because those kind of questions can lead to disability information, but they can lead to other information. You know, why did you fail to show up? Maybe because it was a family emergency. Maybe because your car was broken down. And so since the question isn't directed specifically to medical information, most courts are going to say that's a question that's not seeking medical information. It's a voluntary disclosure, not protected by the ADA. The Wiggins case also found for the employer. In this case, you had a medical technician who experienced what the employee called a panic attack, and ultimately was diagnosed with a bipolar disorder. And she gave her doctor permission to inform her supervisor as to what was going on for her. And when she returned to work, it turned out the coworkers, as well as some of the patients at this particular medical facility, had learned of her bipolar diagnosis. And the court said, you know, even though this is medical information, it's not confidential because it was a voluntary disclosure. They said, really, the only times, there's two types of disclosures that are considered confidential, medical inquiries and employee health programs. And this wasn't really an inquiry or an employee health program. It was just the employee's decision to disclose to the employer. And therefore, it wasn't covered. And even though later the employee sought provided documentation of the bipolar disorder and seeking FMLA leave, it didn't disclose that the initial disclosure was voluntary. So even though you subsequently provide information that is deemed protected, if that initial disclosure is deemed voluntary, it does not have to be kept confidential. At least that's what most courts say. Some more cases on this issue, EEOC versus CR England. This is a case where you had a truck driver who disclosed voluntarily his HIV status to his employer, and he was supposed to provide training for other potential truck drivers. And the employer and the employee actually came up with sort of this bizarre concept of him informing his trainees that he had HIV, which I think is such a strange thing. I mean, why you would need to inform a trainee that your trainer has HIV when there's no risk of communicating HIV by, you know, training about truck driving, seems very strange to me. But the court ultimately said that because he voluntarily disclosed this, it was not protected under the ADA. You got a case that went the other way, the Mahran case, that basically allowed a confidentiality claim to proceed when the plaintiff didn't claim there was an adverse employment action. This was really, I think this is a pretty odd case, but the reason we have it in here is that what the court said here is that you don't have to show an adverse action, like you're terminated or demoted, when the confidentiality has, that the confidentiality itself is a cause of action in and of itself. And in fact, this court at least said that if all you're suing for is confidentiality, you don't even have to exhaust under the EEOC requirements, because the EEOC exhaustion requirements are only when you have an adverse action. So if you have a breach of confidentiality and you've suffered some sort of damages, like the shame that we talked about in the earlier case, you could go straight to court. I'm not sure that there are other courts that have held this, but you should be aware there's at least one court that says that you don't have to exhaust your EEOC administrative remedies before going to court if it's just about confidentiality. The Kingston case is the next case, and that involved an employer telling the employee, he was saying that the employee was not spending enough time on the plant floor. The employee in this case had chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, and it was having a real hard time walking around and breathing, and so he was asking an assistant to go on the plant floor and so he could just do his administrative job in the office. And he was recognizing that he probably would need some sort of reasonable accommodation, but before he actually had that accommodation meeting where they talked about accommodations, he disclosed his COPD to the company nurse as well as a supervisor, and then the employer then shared that condition with coworkers. And he claimed it was a violation of the ADA, and the court said it's not really here, because what you did was you first voluntarily disclosed your COPD, and it was not in response to an inquiry about your ability to perform job functions. It wasn't in the context yet for the accommodation meeting. And since it was really, in this case, all about timing, the fact that he had disclosed before the formal reasonable accommodation requirement, interactive process requirement, and it was not in response to any kind of request for medical information, the court found that it was a voluntary disclosure. Now, I think this case could have gone a different way, depending on your judge here, because it really was, he had been questioned about his performance of job duties when he started talking about a COPD, when they're saying, well, you know, you're not doing a great job spending time on the plant floor, and that's an important part of your job, and that's when he had disclosed the COPD. So I think it's definitely arguable that it really was in response to an employer asking about, you know, what was going on with him specifically, and that you could argue that it was in response to a medical related question or a question that would lead to medical information under the EEOC's view. But that's at least what we have here. There's also this concept of a need to know basis, and we have a few cases doing this. The Lee versus City of Columbus case, I think, is an important one because it's something that I think a lot of employers are starting to look at. And that is, in the City of Columbus, they were requiring their employees to provide information as the nature of an illness when they returned from sick leave. If the sick leave was over, I think, 2 or 3 days, you had to provide a doctor's note that didn't just say that you're sick, but also said the nature of your illness. And the employee said, well, that's disability-related questions. you have to keep it confidential, and they hadn't kept this information confidential, and so he had sued under the ADA. And the court said, no, this was not specifically related to asking specifically about a diagnosis. The nature of an illness is not generally a disability inquiry, because it could be an illness that's not necessarily rising to the level of disability. So the court found that that was not a breach of confidentiality under the ADA. The thing that they said in this case that was also, I think you should be aware of, is this was the case that was brought not under the ADA, but under the Rehabilitation Act. Remember, that's the act that provides non-discrimination for entities that receive federal funding. And the court here said, well, we understand that the Rehab Act incorporates the ADA's requirements generally about confidentiality, but the language is a little bit different here in that the Rehab Act talks about inquiries that are intended to reveal a disability, whereas the ADA talks about, and the EEOC guidance talks about, likely to reveal. And so they said, well, since there's no showing that it was intended to reveal a disability, that it could be revealing some medical information that's not rising to the level of disability, it doesn't violate any confidentiality. There's a case going the other way that actually isn't in our PowerPoint that I wanted to call your attention to in case you're interested in this issue. This is Conroy versus New York State Department of Corrections. Conroy versus New York State Department of Corrections. The site, if you want that, is 333F3rd88, 333F3rd88. It's a Second Circuit case in 2003. And it was a similar case involving where the Department of Corrections were requiring employees to provide doctor's note with medical information why they were out, identifying the medical condition they were out for. And that court said that that was a disability-related inquiry, and you had to keep that confidential. Now, that case was under the ADA and not the Rehab Act, so one of the distinguishing features between the Lee case and the Conroy case would be what statute was brought under. But I think it's also just a different interpretation by the courts as to sort of the breadth of medical information and whether or not you're going to consider it to be disability-related or broader, and you could also be providing information that's not specifically an ADA disability. The O'Neill case is a case where you had a doctor who was disclosing examination results. The person had a heart ailment, and he disclosed it to a local pension board, and the court said that was okay. You can do that kind of redisclosure is okay because the pension board had to certify things for a hiring process, and so that was allowed to proceed. Excuse my phone, it's ringing. I'll let it ring through. And then the other case on this slide is the Tucker case, and this was a case involving a work-related examination. The employee had disclosed initially at the work examination that they had a medical condition that required a corrective device, and she subsequently injured her back, and for some reason the employer decided to send an email worldwide about the employee's medical condition, and she sued under the ADA, and the court said that medical information had to be treated as confidential and should not have been disclosed. This case involved a situation where she had disclosed that information to her initial company, and then that company was bought out by another company. And so the newly acquiring company said, well, we didn't get that information originally. It was the former company that got the information. We're not bound by that confidentiality requirement. And the court disagreed and said, when you acquire another company that got information in confidential nature, that has to be kept confidential as well. That duty of confidentiality then shifts to you as well. The next case is the Giacco case out of New York, and this was a person who had tested positive for drug use, marijuana, on a couple occasions, and subsequently that drug use of his was leaked to the press and got out, and he sued under the ADA saying it violated his confidentiality rights. And the court said, yes, they should have kept this information confidential. The fact that it got into the paper shows that there was some sort of breach of confidentiality. But he ultimately was not able to continue with his case because he couldn't show an adverse action or any kind of tangible injury in that situation. So he wasn't able to continue with that. The next thing we wanted to talk about were employee assistance programs. These often come up in contexts where employers are referring employees who are having difficulties in the workplace to employee assistance programs. And the EEOC guidance does talk about these issues as well, and you've got a link to that on your PowerPoint. And generally, we lay out that the employee assistance counselors can ask employees about their medical conditions. As long as they don't act on behalf of the employer, they're supposed to shield information, disability-related information, from decision makers, and as long as they don't have the power to affect employment decisions. So they're, as long as they're really a service for the employee, they're entitled to get information and then have to keep it confidential. However, we have a case, the Barger case, which indicates that there are ways for the employee assistance program to provide some information to the employer that is permissible. This was a case involving an employee who had a lot of stress-related issues. He was acting out at work and was referred to the EAP doctor. And after that review by the EAP doctor, the employer's personnel group, called the Personnel Action Advisory Group, got together, and the doctor, when he was in that meeting, had said that he believed that the person needed to be terminated, and he gave them some information. I'm just going to read to you what they said. The doctor said, "This employee thinks very highly of himself, that he is a do-it-all. He sees himself as the absolute best manager. He has some behavior traits that will never change. You will never get him to not ping off the walls. He admitted to having an explosive temperament and overreacts. It's a longstanding personality pattern, and he blames everyone else for his issues." Based on that information, they terminated him, and he claimed that the EAP doctor had violated his confidentiality by disclosing disability information. The court said that really wasn't disability-related information. It was more general job-related observations, and the EAP doctor, on a need-to-know basis, could disclose and inform on necessary restrictions. So we wanted to do a quick poll and see what people thought about that case and whether you thought that the EAP doctor was what he was sharing were necessary restrictions and job-related observations, or whether you think what he was sharing was enough to likely lead to information about a disability. If you think yes, that they were only sharing job-related observations and therefore permissible, you should vote A. If you think no, that literally was something violating the employee's confidentiality, please vote B. And then again, if you're using the keypad, it would be control 1 for A, yes, it was permissible, or control 2 for no, it was impermissible. So please vote now. Okay, and we'll check out what people have voted for. And it looks like we got a split here that 19 folks thought that no, what they did was not a violation of the ADA. I'm getting the question confused a little bit. That yes, what they did was permissible under the ADA. 13 of you said that, and 19 of you said no, that wasn't permissible. It was likely to lead to a disclosure of disability. And you know, I think this one's a close question, and we don't have all the facts here. But it is one I think that's pretty tricky. So EAP doctors should be really careful on the information they provide to the employer when decisions are going to be made. The next case we want to talk about is a case the EEOC brought involving an employer who posted a schedule for the HR department about people and the accommodations they needed, and they had this chart saying if you had an accommodation, you would be listed, have an ADA after your name, and if you had a non-occupational disability, you have DIS after your name. And unfortunately, this information got out to other people in the workplace, and one employee with diabetes was really harassed horribly because he had gotten an accommodation to be assigned to a day shift, and there was a lot of resentment in the workplace that he got that accommodation. And so they had all kinds of threats of violence. One employee referred to the ADA as the, and I'm quoting, the American Dickhead Association. Another coworker said, "I'm going to kick your ass because you're getting preferential treatment." I mean, really bad harassment. And the company nurse had disclosed his diabetes to a coworker. But the court ultimately said this was not confidential information. They held that the accommodation that was involved here didn't fit under the confidentiality categories. This is when we talked about that sometimes reasonable accommodation information isn't protected. This is a court that goes that way because it doesn't fall under a valid pre-employment inquiry, it's not a voluntary medical exam, and it's not an inquiry that an employer has asked the person to do or an examination they've asked to do. So because it was affirmative by the employee, they said it didn't fit with any of the EEOC guidance, and therefore they found that it was not confidential. I think even though the employer won here, I think to engage in this kind of disclosure is really dangerous for employers, and I think it's certainly not a best practice, and I think there are other courts that would go the other way, but we wanted to let you know there are different viewpoints on these. And then employers often ask, you know, we're really struggling here. What do we do when people give us confidential information, like for reasonable accommodations, and employees are resenting the fact that somebody's getting preferential treatment? And the Williams and Dawes Bush case give us some information on what the EEOC thinks. So I'm just going to read to you. It says, when responding to a question about why a coworker is receiving what is perceived as different or special treatment, an employer might explain that it has a policy of assisting any employee who encounters difficulties in the workplace, and that many of the issues are personal, and that it is employer's policy to respect employee privacy. So say, look, you know, we respect employees' privacy. We assist people who have difficulties in the workplace, but we're not going to share that information with you. And, you know, difficulties in the workplace can be a lot of things, including disability-related. And then the Dawes Bush case goes on further and talks about that it's not unlawful for an employer to disclose to coworkers that an employee was medically disqualified from performing certain duties, because that's really a work status, and you can be medically disqualified from certain work duties even if you don't have a disability. So to say somebody's medically disqualified, the EEOC says is permissible, whereas you can't say that they are getting accommodation for a disability. Whether you think that's a valid distinction or not, that's the EEOC's perspective on that issue. So that is time for a break on the presentation and to open it up to see if we have any questions. If you have any questions, you can type them into the chat
Barry,
box.
Barry, you have a number of questions we'll in the chat box. Would you like to read them, or shall I read them for you?
Oh. If you could read them for me, I'm having a difficult time finding them.
I would be happy to. The DOL instructions that accompany their suggested FMLA form notes the language that can be used by a healthcare provider to justify the leave. Do you believe that the disability itself must be disclosed if the other qualifications are met?
Yeah, I think generally, I don't know how this has gone under the FMLA specifically, and Alan may have a good answer for this, but I think most courts have said that just providing the medical information without the diagnosis, some courts at least I know have said that the diagnosis itself is necessary in order to fully evaluate the accommodation request.
Hi, Barry. Yes, and I answered the question from Barry Glass. I actually answered him directly. That was my thought, too. I quickly pulled up the Department of Labor form, and it seems like in the form you don't necessarily have to disclose a diagnosis. But I agree with you. You know, it's clear under the ADA you have to have an impairment, so I think you need to disclose a condition. Under the FMLA, which is Department of Labor and different regulations and guidance, the form doesn't make it clear, but I think employers do have a right to verify that someone has a serious health condition, and I think that would almost necessarily include disclosure of a diagnosis. But I can't recall seeing cases on that issue.
Great. Thanks, Al.
There is a follow-up question. Would the other speakers please close their microphones so we don't get an echo. There is a follow-up question from Barry is asking, isn't it sufficient to state that the employee has, quote, a serious health condition that requires?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just going on to what Alan and I were discussing. And so, you know, we haven't necessarily looked at this within the FMLA context, and you're right that the form is a little bit different, but at least with respect to the ADA confidentiality provisions, which do involve issues of confidentiality, attaching once you do apply for FMLA. The ADA is going to look about whether the person has a disability or not, and that involves sharing whether you have an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. So, I mean, I think it's fine for people to provide limited information. Employers may come back and ask for additional information, but if you're talking about ADA confidentiality, I think it's clear that if you disclose anything in an FMLA form seeking leave under the FMLA, that is in response to employer-required information, which is what the ADA confidentiality provisions cover, if that makes sense. So, I mean, it's almost irrelevant whether what it is that you're disclosing for FMLA when you're talking about ADA confidentiality purposes, because whatever you're putting in that FMLA form, because it's in response to the employer's requirement for you to fill it out before you get FMLA leave, that has to be kept confidential. Were there any other questions that you saw?
There are no more questions that have been typed into the chat box. Shall we just continue then?
Yeah, let's do that. And then if people have other questions on this issue or any of the other issues that Alan bring up, I think we'll have time at the end. So I'll turn it over to Alan at this point. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Barry and Tanya. We'll move on to slide 26. And we're going to start with looking at, you know, Barry looked at Title I of the ADA. Now we're going to look at Titles 2 and 3 of the ADA, as well as the Rehabilitation Act, Civil Rights Act, and 14th Amendment. And one thing I want to point out initially is that Title 1 really is the only part of the ADA that explicitly contains protections for confidentiality in the statute and in the regulations. Courts have kind of adapted that into Titles 2 and 3, and it's in some of the technical assistance. But Title 1 has the explicit confidential protection, which is not found in Titles 2 or 3 of the ADA. And I think that's because, as the first bullet point points out, employers are entitled to substantial medical information in some circumstances, or at least limited medical information in some circumstances. Under Titles 2 and 3, it's much less likely that they'll be requesting much information. But to give an example, the Title II Technical Assistance Manual from the Department of Justice states that a public entity may not make unnecessary inquiries into the existence of a disability. And if we look at the Title III regulations, the Department of Justice regulations, for example, for service animals, or for other power mobility devices, make it clear also that a Title III entity cannot inquire into the nature of a disability, just whether the service animal or the power-driven mobility device is made necessary due to a disability without the person having to identify that disability. So the issue can come up in several settings. It comes up in the education setting, I think most often, because when a student needs an accommodation in school, they need to go to the school disability office and to provide medical support for the accommodations they need, whether it's something like extra time on papers or tests, time and a half, or double time are common accommodations, or they might need note takers, using a computer or formula sheet during testing, or a quiet testing environment, or we had a case for someone who needed a testing environment that was accessible to them due to their environmental sensitivity. So we actually had to investigate what types of cleaning materials and bleaches and things were used to clean because of his sensitivities. But I think the duty would be the same, and as we'll see later on, even beyond the ADA, there are other laws that protect confidentiality. So I think for a provider, it's a good practice to anytime you get medical information to protect the confidentiality, even though, as we saw, some of the court cases said that the disclosure did not violate the law. A best practice, I think, still is to protect confidentiality. And the issue can also come up in camps, sports programs, park districts, etc. And here's the example I just mentioned about the Title II and III regulations from the Department of Justice regarding service animals and other power-driven mobility devices. And for those two types of subcategories, the regulations prohibit inquiries into the nature of a disability. Entity can only inquire if the animal or device is required due to a disability. So we have there, just to quote as an example, for mobility devices, a public accommodation shall not ask an individual using a wheelchair or other powers of the mobility device questions about the nature and extent of the individual's disability. However, one thing I wanted to note, and I actually wasn't necessarily thrilled with this, but there was a Department of Justice settlement against LSAC, which is the organization that administers the law school aptitude test, the LSAT test. And there was a settlement with the Department of Justice, but the LSAC was allowed as part of that settlement to annotate at the bottom of the form that complainant received an accommodation with the following language: accommodations provided pursuant to a settlement agreement between the LSAC and the US of A. So they're not disclosing what the disability was, but they are disclosing that the person did have accommodations due to our disability. And it's still an open issue whether that type of thing, which is called flagging, is appropriate. And in the next slide, we look at some of the flagging issues. So sometimes when people take tests with accommodations, the fact that they had the accommodations is flagged, and then the question becomes, is the school that's looking at the test scores going to kind of discount their scores a little bit because they did receive an accommodation? And it's not settled on court, and there haven't been many cases on it. The one case we have cited there is Doe versus the National Board of Medical Examiners, where they said the plaintiff didn't have standing to raise the flagging issue because he passed the examination. So kind of a no harm, no foul court ruling. But what is good to note is that recently the College Board, the people who give the ACT, SAT, and the GMAT, all those organizations have discontinued flagging. But I think the MBME for medical exams and the LSAC for law school admission exams do still use flagging. And I have there at the bottom of the slide, you can see there's four or five different law review articles on the practice of flagging and whether it's appropriate and a good practice, et cetera. So for people interested in that subject, I encourage you to look at those law review articles. The next case we're going to look at is a Title II case, Fleming versus State University of New York. In this case, a doctor brought suit under Title II of the ADA, as well as Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act and Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act, alleging a violation of confidentiality by the director of the residency program who disclosed his sickle cell anemia to a potential employer. So one thing to note is, and I think Barry mentioned this as well, confidentiality extends beyond the employment period, so it could cover job references. One thing to note, this is more an employment situation, so we'll see there are some issues with the Title II claim. In this case, an employee was in the hospital. The supervisor asked, "Why are you in the hospital?" And the employee disclosed that he had sickle cell anemia. And the employer said, "Well, you better get a doctor's note before you can return to work." And then the employer later disclosed the condition to a subsequent potential employer. And the plaintiff tried to claim that the Title I confidentiality provisions also constituted discrimination under Title II of the ADA and Section 504. And just in case I didn't explain this before, Title I of the ADA covers employment settings, Title II covers public entities and government services, and Title III covers private businesses, places of public accommodation. So the court ruled that the confidentiality claims can go forward under Section 504 and Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act, as the disclosure was not voluntary. It was in response to a direct question. And it was in response to a medical inquiry, not a friendly conversation, as the employer tried to claim. But the Title II claim was dismissed because Title II does not cover employment, only Title I covers employment. But because the employer received federal financial assistance under the Rehabilitation Act, then Section 504 would apply. And the doctor was an independent contractor, so therefore he couldn't go under Title I, which is why he tried to go under Title II. The court held that the confidentiality requirements of Title I do apply under Section 504 for employment situations, not necessarily for non-employment situations. And the court also held that there was a possible confidentiality violation under Section 1983 as, quote, the plaintiff's 14th Amendment right to privacy and health information does entitle him to confidentiality with regard to his sickle cell anemia. And you've probably heard about 14th Amendment right to privacy in a slew of Supreme Court cases, including Roe versus Wade and Griswold versus Connecticut with regards to reproductive rights. So there is a right to privacy under the 14th Amendment as recognized by the Supreme Court. The court also stated, and I quote, there are few matters that are quite so personal as the status of one's health, and few matters the dissemination of which one would prefer to maintain greater control over. Acknowledging that this is very private and a person has a right to maintain who knows about their private medical information. And in this court, in this case, the court went on to, in some depth, about the stigmatization, discrimination faced by people with sickle cell anemia, and they also talked about the stigmatization, having trouble with that word, and discrimination faced by people with who are living with HIV or people with cancer as well. So the nature of the condition was a factor in the court's analysis. The next case is Brady versus Potter. And Potter, this was a case involving the post office. Whenever you see Potter as a defendant, that's probably a good bet. And the court held here, similarly to the other court, that the violation of Title I's confidentiality provisions are actionable under the Rehabilitation Act, Section 504. In this case, a job applicant with depression was required to submit medical information to show her ability to do the job. Clearly, an employer-mandated inquiry, and under the Rehab Act, the Title I confidentiality provisions did apply. The next case was Stokes, which involved a Social Security representative who visited a patient in the hospital and learned that she was living with HIV, and then the Social Security rep told other people about this person's condition. And the courts then distinguished the other cases, which involved an employment relationship. In this case, there was no employment relationship. It was someone from the Social Security office. And it wasn't with a Social Security employee. It was someone seeking services from Social Security. And the court held that Section 504 does not include confidentiality violations where there is no employment relationship. So it's important to keep that distinction in mind. And I quote from the court, the importation of the standards established by the ADA into the Rehabilitation Act by subsection D is limited to complaints alleging employment discrimination. And then we have a note there that even if there is not an employment relationship, there may be protection for confidentiality rights under state law issues, and that's something we'll look at briefly at the end of this presentation. So even if there is no ADA or Rehabilitation Act confidentiality, keep in mind there's also HIPAA, there's also state law that may apply. Now we're going to look a little more about 14th Amendment privacy and confidentiality issues. We have a Supreme Court case, Whalen versus Roe, where the court recognized the right to privacy. There exists in the United States Constitution a right to privacy protecting the individual interest in avoiding disclosure of personal matters. And as we noted in the case earlier, courts look at the nature of the medical condition at issue. So confidentiality is more likely to apply when someone has a condition that's seen as more serious, such as cancer, living with HIV or sickle cell anemia, rather if someone has a flu or a broken foot or something, then it's likely the court might not read that the privacy and confidentiality of the 14th Amendment apply. And then there's a lot of cases involving prisoners on this issue, which makes sense because under the 14th Amendment it needs to be a state actor, not just a private employer. It needs to be an arm of the state. So in the Powell case, there was a prisoner living with HIV, and the court said that the prisoner does have a constitutional right to privacy, but it may be limited by prison officials, quote, only to the extent that their actions are reasonably related to legitimate penological interests. And then I have a few other 14th Amendment inmate cases there. So in the Hamilton case, there was no right to privacy concerning a person's high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and hepatitis A. In the Rush case, no privacy regarding a wrist injury and stomach problems. In the Rodriguez case, no right to privacy concerning treatment for proctitis, which is a non-toxic inflammation of the mucous tissue of the rectum and internal hemorrhoids. And in the Watson case, the court said that there was no confidentiality as the prison had a legitimate interest in disclosing the prisoner's hepatitis C to the Inmate Grievance Review Board, as the prisoner himself, the plaintiff, raised that issue in his grievance. On to the next slide. Here we have the Madsen case versus the Board of Ed of the City School District of New York, a 2009 case. In this case, the plaintiff claimed that, there were allegations that the plaintiff was misusing sick leave, and she claimed that those allegations violated her confidentiality as it revealed that she had fibromyalgia. And in this case, it really appeared that the plaintiff was misusing her sick leave because they found that she was engaging in other activities when she was supposedly homesick. She only raised the 14th Amendment, 1983 constitutional right to privacy, not ADA or Rehab Act claims. And the court said that her medical condition falls well below the level of seriousness that typically triggers a constitutional right to privacy. I think people who have fibromyalgia, that the condition can be quite debilitating. Maybe there's not the same stigma that applies to other conditions, but the court held that her condition was not, in their words, serious enough to trigger constitutional protections. And further, her complaint was faulty in that the public disclosure she didn't allege that exposed her to discrimination, hostility, or intolerance. And that there was no harm in the Fleming case we discussed earlier. The person had a job offer revoked. Here, there was no similar harm. But in this case, the court kind of let you know where they stood right off the bat. The first sentence of the case was really from the Department of Education's point of view. This case demonstrates why it is difficult to run the New York City Department of Education. So they were really looking at it from the entity's point of view. Okay, now we're going to move on from the 14th Amendment to discuss GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. And I have to make a disclosure. I have not handled any GINA cases myself. I've read the statute, the regulations, EEOC guidance on this issue. And there's very few cases on this. The EEOC recently published data on filings in Illinois in 2011. There were about 23 GINA filings, which was, I think, less than 1% of the filings. I think in New York there were only 5 filings in 2011 under GINA. So I think this is an area of the law that's probably going to grow in importance, and it's important now, but there just have not been many cases under it. And then just to provide a little comic relief, I included pictures of different GINAs from the screen. So we'll start with Gina Gershon in the first slide. And here we have Gina Rowlands. And to talk about GINA, the law, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act prohibits genetic discrimination in the workplace. It took effect in November of 2009 and forbids using genetic information when making employment decisions. It restricts an employer's ability to acquire the genetic information of employees and limits the disclosure of the genetic information. There are two main titles. We're mostly going to talk about the second title, but Title I addresses genetic non-discrimination in health insurance and is governed by Department of Labor, Department of Health and Human Services, and the Treasury Department. Title II addresses employment discrimination on the basis of genetic information, and that part is governed by the EEOC, and that's where we're going to focus. And GINA also contains a confidentiality provision that's the same as the ADA, although that some genetic information, although genetic information cannot be sought from job applicants. So, and under the ADA, you can't get medical information from job applicants either. Employers can only get medical information once they make a conditional offer of employment. But here, employers cannot get genetic information from job applicants. And as I mentioned, it's a new law with a developing body of case law. And here we have Gina Davis, and Title II of GINA prohibits employers, unions, employment agencies, and training programs from hiring, firing, or otherwise discriminating against employees on the basis of their genetic information. Also prohibits limiting, segregating, or classifying employees in any way that would deprive them of employment opportunities or negatively affect their status as an employee on the basis of genetic information. It prohibits employers from requesting, requiring, or purchasing genetic information of an employee or family members of the employee. But there is an exclusion for medical information that is not genetic information, and we'll look at that definition in a second, even if the condition has a genetic basis. So if someone needs to disclose a medical condition to get leave under the ADA or FMLA, that's not a violation of GINA, even if their condition has a genetic basis. And at the bottom of the slide, there's links to two pieces of guidance from the EEOC, which I think are very helpful. So for people who have questions, I strongly recommend you look at that. There's EEOC guidance in general on genetic information, and then there's a Q&A for small businesses. And the next slide, we have Gina Lola Brigida, and this is a definition of genetic information, which is important to have a good grasp of under GINA. Genetic information is any information regarding an individual's genetic tests, the genetic tests of individual's family members, any diseases, disorders, or conditions of an individual's family. Family medical history is included in this definition, because the information is often used to determine what conditions an individual is predisposed to getting. And there's a broad definition of family member. It includes marriage, birth, adoption, placement for adoption, or first, second, third degree, or fourth degree relatives. So it is a broad definition. The next slide does not have a picture of a GINA in there. But I included this because genetics is amazing. So here we have the Marx brothers, three brothers, same parents, all same environment, all born and raised in New York. Yet one brother is a sharp-witted, sarcastic jerk. Another brother is a nonverbal anarchist. And the third brother is Italian. So it just shows the diversity of genetics. And in this slide, we have the definition of a genetic test. Which is defined as an analysis of human DNA, RNA, chromosomes, proteins, metabolites that detects genotypes, mutations, or chromosomal changes. It does not include an analysis of proteins or metabolites that does not detect genotypes, mutations, or chromosomal changes. It does not include a test for the presence of alcohol or illegal drugs. However, if a test is done to determine whether an individual has a genetic predisposition for alcoholism or drug use, that test is considered a genetic test. GINA provides for a private civil cause of action under Title II of GINA. Exhaustion of administrative remedies through the EEOC is required. The statute of limitations is 180 days or 300 days if there is a FERPA, a state agency, that also handles the discrimination claim. And as with the ADA, federal employees must report any alleged discrimination to the EEO officer within 45 days. You can only recover under GINA for intentional discrimination. There's no disparate impact cause of action as there is under the ADA. That's where a law that's neutral on its face might have a disparate impact on people with disabilities. That's recognized under the ADA, not under GINA, although the commission will be assessing whether to change that. And Title II of GINA does not preclude concurrent claims under other federal laws, in state or federal laws, including the ADA and Section 504. Available remedies can include compensatory and punitive damages, attorney's fees, injunctive relief, which can include reinstatement and hiring, back pay, or other equitable remedies. And like the ADA, retaliation against employees for asserting their rights is also prohibited under GINA. Under confidentiality, Gina adopts the ADA's general rule regarding confidentiality in the storage of genetic information. It must be maintained on separate forms, kept in separate medical files, treated as a confidential medical record, with limited access only to those who need to know. But one big difference is that any medical examination done by an employer must explicitly include genetic information. But if an employer does obtain genetic information, it can be kept in the same file as other medical information subject to the ADA. So very similar confidentiality provisions. And we're talking about some permitted disclosures under GINA. Under limited circumstances, an employer, employment agency, labor organization, or joint labor management committee can disclose genetic information concerning an employee or member to the employee or the member of a labor organization at the written request of the employee or member of such organization. That means if a union member says, go ahead and disclose my genetic information, at the request of the individual, they can disclose it. If there is research which follows the Health and Human Services Policy for Human Research, genetic information can be disclosed to an occupational or health research. It can be disclosed pursuant to a court order as long as the individual is notified and it's limited to the scope of the order. It could be disclosed to government officials investigating GINA compliance as part of the certification process for FMLA leave or relevant state laws, or to a public health agency if a contagious disease presents an imminent hazard of death or life-threatening illness and the individual is notified of the disclosure. So these are the limited circumstances where disclosure is permitted under GINA. Very little case law, as I mentioned, on this. Genetic testing is not yet widespread amongst employers, and there's been very little action in the court. Almost all the cases we found were brought by pro se plaintiffs and were dismissed for various reasons, sometimes poor pleading, failure to state a claim type of thing. So we have a few cases there. The Bullock case, in that case, they didn't allege any use or misuse of genetic information, so that was dismissed. In the Poor case, a person disclosed their wife's MS to the employer, and they raised claims under GINA and the ADA. The court dismissed the GINA information. Even though MS may have a genetic basis, it was not genetic information that was disclosed. It was just the medical condition. However, in that case, the Poor case, the court held that the ADA claims could continue as there was possibly a confidentiality violation under the ADA, but since it was not genetic information per se, the GINA claim was dismissed. And in the Citron case, there was no allegations that a genetic test was required or that genetic info was acquired, so there was really no basis for a GINA claim. And we think there should be more litigation and maybe more successful litigation as testing becomes more prevalent, and it's possible that testing won't become more prevalent because of GINA as well. A few additional regulation requirements. So employee includes both present employees, former employees, and job applicants. So it's broad. It doesn't end when the employment relationship ends. And job applicants are also protected as well as current employees. And there's also something that's very important. When employers seek medical documentation, they must include a warning to the employee not to provide genetic information. If the employee ignores that warning and provides genetic information anyway, the employer will not be liable because it would be deemed as an inadvertent disclosure. So some prohibited requests include seeking information in current health status in a way that's likely to result in obtaining genetic information, conducting internet researches on an individual in a way that's likely to result in obtaining genetic information, although information that's commercially and publicly available would not result in GINA liability, and also actively listening to third-party conversations or searching an individual's personal effects to obtain genetic information is also prohibited under GINA. There is a safe harbor provision. And this is what I alluded to before. If when requesting medical information, the employer includes the warning about not including genetic information, and then it's provided anyway, any genetic information it acquires in response is deemed as inadvertent because they did issue the warning. So that's one best practice for employers, is to make sure you put that warning in there. And additionally, when seeking medical information under ADA or FMLA, it's acceptable to acquire information that is not genetic information, even if the condition has a genetic basis. That was similar to the case with someone with multiple sclerosis. I need leave because of my multiple sclerosis. Disclosing that condition is not genetic information, even though MS does have a genetic basis. GINA and ADA both apply to paper and electronic records. And there's a special provision about wellness programs. Generally, it's acceptable for employers to offer employees inducement for completing a health risk assessment that contains questions about genetic information or family medical histories, as long as it makes it clear the information is not required to obtain the inducement, which makes the information voluntary to provide. Although if someone does provide that information, it must remain confidential. And now we're going to look at HIPAA, PSQIA, I'm not sure how that acronym is pronounced, and then very briefly at state law. We have about 15 minutes left, so I'm going to try to move a little quickly through these slides to leave time for questions. So the purpose of HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, was to improve the portability and continuity of health insurance coverage to combat waste, fraud, and abuse in the health insurance and healthcare delivery. And there were additionally security and privacy regulations that were added. These address the privacy and disclosure of healthcare information. So covered entities include health plans, which include health insurance companies, company health plans, HMOs, government health programs such as Medicare, also healthcare providers and healthcare clearinghouses. Includes group plans, major medical plans, flexible spending accounts, vision, dental, group, long-term care plans. It includes self-insured plans if the employer retains some administrative functions. It includes healthcare clearinghouses, which are entities that convert health information from non-standard formats into HIPAA standard formats and vice versa. Employers are specifically exempted from coverage, so employers are not covered by HIPAA, very important. However, the privacy rule does apply to an employer that receives private health information from a covered entity. And HIPAA protects protected health information, PHI, which includes individually identifiable information, whether oral or written, which relates to a person's physical or mental health, the provision of health care to that person, or the payment for health care. And again, it does not cover employment records, HIPAA does not, educational records, or de-identified information, which means that the person is not identified along with the information, their name is redacted, for example, even if health information is included in these records and they are otherwise possessed by a covered entity. And then there's a business associate provision in allowing healthcare providers and plans to give PHI to business associated. The privacy rule conditions disclosure on the provider or plan obtaining by contract assurances that the business associate will use the information only for the purposes of which they were engaged by the covered entity, will safeguard the information from misuse, and will help the covered entity comply with its duties to provide individuals with access to health information and history of certain disclosures. And then we have something I actually didn't even know about until researching for this PowerPoint, the Patient Safety and Quality Improvement Act. I'll go by PSQIA just because I like how it sounds. This also contains confidentiality, and it's a voluntary reporting system to enhance the data available to assess and resolve patient safety and healthcare issues. Regulations were published in 2008 and became effective in January of 2009. And it provides federal privilege and confidentiality protections for patient safety information, which is called patient safety work product, which includes information collected and created during reporting and analysis of patient safety events. And HHS is authorized to impose civil penalties, monetary penalty for violation of patient safety confidentiality under PSQIA. There's no private right of action under either HIPAA or PSQIA, but complaints can be filed at HHS. We have a link there for filing a complaint. We have a link there for an HHS fact sheet on HIPAA privacy issues, as well as one on PSQIA infos. I think might be a typo there. Sorry about that. So there's some fact sheets on HIPAA and PSQIA. Again, civil monetary penalty is there, but it depends on the offender's scienter, which is a legal word, which means their intent and knowledge of wrongdoing. And then without going through the violations, an unknowing violation is not as high a penalty as a violation resulting from willful neglect that are corrected. And then that type of penalty is lower than violations resulting from willful neglect that are not corrected. And then state law, I'm going to just breeze through this because we only included Illinois because that's what we're familiar with. But Illinois, for example, has a Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Confidentiality Act. There's also a Confidentiality Act for people with HIV or AIDS. So just remember, just because HIPAA doesn't apply or another confidentiality law might not apply, there still might be state laws that apply. And this is to make sure that patient's information is not released without the patient's consent, with some narrow exceptions. There must be consensual disclosure of information, and it might be for a limited purpose, and then an employer must get permission to redisclose information, even if it's for the application of benefits. Now I'm just going to move quickly, so I'm not going to hit all the information on this slide. Under state law, you can get actual damages as well as injunctive relief and fees and costs. And here we have the Rent-A-Center case, which is interesting. We talk about that case a lot because it involved pre-employment personality testing, which the Seventh Circuit found to be unlawful. But the district court case noted that there were issues, there were questions that were asked, which included information regarding sexual preferences and orientation, religious beliefs and practices, and medical conditions. And went to send or distribute this report to an employee supervisor and place it in the personnel file. And went to center had no policies for protecting the confidentiality of these information that's done as part of the application process. And the court went on, the claim was that these were psychological tests and that by disclosing them, the employer violated the Illinois Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Confidentiality Act because it contains psychological characteristics of the employee. And the court held that it is possible that this might state a claim under the Illinois Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Confidentiality Act, so therefore the claim was allowed to proceed. And as I mentioned, the big part of Carriker was the fact that the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory was given to job applicants, and that was found to be an unlawful practice by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And we have some practical tips for employers and employees. One, periodic training under the ADA and these other laws is always important for new hires. We see so many cases where a new supervisor comes in who's not adequately trained and ends up violating someone's rights. Employers should have strict policies to protect confidentiality information, keep it separate from the personnel information. As the EEOC recommended in the cases that Barry discussed, it's good for employers to advise employees of confidentiality rights at trainings and personnel manuals and orientation materials and by posting notices. And then when someone says, you know, why does this person have an accommodation and I don't, and they're told, sorry, we can't tell you, then at least the employee who's complaining would know that there's a basis for protecting that confidentiality. And most people at a certain point in their lives, they realize that everyone has private information that they don't want shared, and hopefully people will understand that. One thing, some employers like to get a lot of medical information. I don't necessarily think that's a best practice due to all the potential liability that can emanate from a confidentiality breach, whether it's the ADA, HIPAA, state law or 14th Amendment, there's a lot of laws that come into play once an employer has medical information. An employer should remember there can be no claim for disability discrimination unless the employer knows that someone has a disability or regards them as having a disability. And for employers, it's a good practice to include information on GINA in all requests for medical information and to warn the employee not to disclose genetic information as part of any information provided. And now some practical tips for employees. One, because we saw those cases on voluntary disclosure, avoid voluntary disclosures. If you put the information out there, then you will probably be prevented from putting forth a confidentiality claim later. When seeking accommodations, provide necessary information so you're engaging in the interactive process, but only provide what is necessary, not more. Avoid voluntary disclosures. All you need to give is information establishing an ADA disability and the need for a reasonable accommodation if your disability is not visible or apparent. If it is a disability that's visible or known by the employer, then an employer might not be entitled to any medical information. And again, we always urge employees to be careful with doctor's notes, make sure they don't disclose too much, make sure they don't say you're not qualified to do your job. So be very careful with medical information that's supplied. We have here our list of resources, ADA National Network, EEOC, JAN, Job Accommodation Network, Equip for Equality, Department of Justice, and Department of Health and Human Services. Illinois lawyers, please email Barry. I'll let him know you attended the whole session, and you can get 1.5 hours of CLE. And then thank you, and I want to let you know about the next session on July 18th on pregnancy, discrimination, disability, and the ADA. You'll be sent a link for an evaluation, so please fill that out.
No.
And I'm stepping on someone's
toes, so I'll
be quiet now.
I just wanted to remind you, we had 2 questions come in. They're over there on the chat area. Now there's 3. I wonder if you would take just the very last moment to address those very short questions.
Sure, I'll try. And Barry, please feel free to pipe in. In higher education, faculty members often want to know the student's diagnosis. I would suggest that the faculty members don't need to know what the diagnosis is. If the disability office thinks a student should get extra time on tests or papers, I think the faculty only needs to know that the disability office thinks that the person is medically qualified to receive that information. We've heard a lot of examples about teachers violating students' confidentiality by disclosing a student's disability. So I think that is a good point, and something like the student is medically qualified. The teacher might not be the one who needs to know what the disability is, they just need to know what the accommodation is. Second question, could you clarify why disclosing MS is not considered disclosure of genetic information? The way the court differentiated, it's disclosing the condition. It's not disclosing the genetic information that gives rise to the condition. For example, genetic information might be the person is predisposed to MS because of this information found on their chromosomes. But a medical condition does not necessarily become genetic information just because it has that genetic basis. So I think it's important, and it might be helpful to, we didn't go through all the definitions, to look at the regulations and really look closely at the definition of genetic information, as I think it's a very specific definition, and there's a difference between genetic information, and that's differentiated from conditions that have a genetic basis. Next question about service animals and the other power device mobility, OPD, MD. Can't quite remember all the letters. States that a specific question to a Title II or III entity can ask a person with a disability. I think the question is this, do you need that device or do you need that service animal due to a disability? And if the person says yes and there's no obvious reason to doubt their answer, I think that's the question that's asked. Do you need this device? Do you need this service animal due to a disability? And I think that's the limit of what you can ask. Barry, please feel free to add or correct any of those.
No, I think that's right. And then you can also ask what if the animal is individually trained to perform a task, and what task is that. So if it's not obvious, like for instance, if you have a blind person, clearly the animal is usually using to assist the person in guiding them. But you could have a service dog who is doing something else that's not readily apparent, and you can ask the person with disability to if the animal is individually trained and what are they tasks are they providing for the person with the disability.
Thank you. Yes, that's a good point.
Thank you very much to both Barry and Alan. This has been a wonderful presentation, and I know everyone felt it was beneficial. I believe that this concludes our session now for the day, and we appreciate everyone's attendance. You will be able to exit the webinar room now by clicking the X at the top right of the page. We will be posting our archives, and we will be sending you a follow-up email with some information from this presentation and information on where you can access both the survey and the archive of the presentation, and contact Barry for your continuing education. So thank you very much. We appreciate everyone's attendance.